Bang, bang.
Hello and welcome to Fang Bangers Podcast. We're chaotic, horny friends rewatching the chaotic, horny HBO series True Blood. I'm Tasia.
And I'm Lottie. You can find the pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky at Fang Bangers Pod with a Z or a Z if you're American. And email us your chaotic, horny thoughts, preferably on True Blood, please, to fangbangerspod at gmail.com.
This week we're discussing Season 1, Episode 4, Escape from Dragon House. The episode aired on September 28th, 2008. It was written by Alan Ball and Brian Buckner and directed by Michael Lehman. And we just have a summary here again from Wiki. When another Bon Temps resident is found murdered under suspicious circumstances, Jason is once again taken into custody, and it is up to Sookie to uncover the identity of the real killer and clear her brother's name. Asking for his help, Bill takes Sookie to the vampire bar Fangtasia, where she is introduced to Eric, a 1,000-year-old Viking vampire and Bill's superior.
So, Tasia, this is your bar, right?
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely my bar. It's also my bar in another way because, fun fact, I have spent most of my adult life living in Long Beach. I don't live there currently, but that's where I have spent the majority of my time. And Fangtasia, the location for that bar, was actually filmed in Long Beach, and it was at
Have to tell me where Long Beach is, I'm afraid.
Long Beach, California. Sorry. It is kind of on the border between Orange County, California, and Los Angeles County. It's technically part of Los Angeles County. But yeah, there's just like this divey bar there called Alex's Bar, and that's where they filmed Fangtasia. So that's a bar that I would go to pretty regularly to go to shows and just to, you know, go to a bar. But that was actual Fangtasia. So it's another
amazing
another way that is my bar.
Amazing. I shall not pry into the amount of mesh clothing and or tip tape you were wearing.
The number's not zero. Let's say that.
So what were your first impressions on the episode then?
Well, I love this one. And I mean, I'm going to have to out myself right now as just like an unapologetic Eric stan. So this is like, you know, first episode with my baby boy. So it's always going to be pretty high ranking for me. So I really like this episode as like an introduction, not only to Eric, but I also am obsessed with Pam. She's the love of my life. And just the atmospheres of Fangtasia, the very like overtly sexual kind of goth vibe is something that I've always been very into. I like this. And it is, it's also an episode that I'm kind of bummed about because I really do like Dawn a lot. And
yeah,
I'm sad to see her go.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% echo everything you said about Eric and Pam. And also, like, the way that... and we'll get into this later, I'm sure. But the way that Fangtasia's introduced and the way they sort of sit apart from it is, I think, it's really interesting. It's really interesting the way they do that. Mm-hmm. The Dawn thing is... I find it notable looking at it from 2023 and going, man, they do like killing women.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally what this entire first season is about. It's just woman after woman. That's kind of a bummer, but it is.
Other than that, there's some pretty high notch and highbrow, I'm sure, comedy with Jason involved in it. In this,
yes.
Do you want to walk us through scene by scene, and we'll sort of jump onto any points we come out? Some of these scenes are quite short, it has to be said.
Yeah, so we start out, Sookie is screaming from the previous cliffhanger where she walks in on and finds Dawn's body. And Jason shows up and he's got flowers. And I'm thinking, like, did he bring a bottle of something? I know he dropped something and it crashed. I'm not sure what it was. Was it just like a bottle of vodka or something? Because that's a Jason-esque apology.
I didn't notice, but yeah, it does.
something it was, like that.
Yeah.
And flowers, and then, you know, he Jasons it right up by immediately kind of just being an idiot about it, throwing flowers, destroying evidence, you know, Jason stuff. And then Dawn's neighbor, who previously the night before had seen Dawn and Jason's big explosive fight and Dawn taking a shot at him and him calling her a bitch and then taking off. So she calls the cops and they show up obviously ready and raring to go to implicate Jason in this murder.
Yeah, I think Jason's high point here is saying, is she all right? And yeah. Suki turns to her and goes, no, she's dead.
Yeah.
So a particularly special moment from our dumb himbo boy there. Not himbo, uh-huh. Sorry. We've already agreed he's not a himbo. Non-himbo.
Definitely not a himbo, but definitely a big giant dum-dum.
Yep.
So then Hoyt and Renee and Arlene and Hoyt's mother, Maxine Fortenberry, who is just, you know, comes right out of the gate as just an absolute ghoul. they're just gossiping about Dawn. You know, it's all very exciting. Like, that's an appropriate word to use to describe that kind of horrific tragedy. You see kind of Hoyt's, you get a nice little background into Hoyt and his mother's dynamic, which is pretty troubling in terms of just, you know, she's a obviously very controlling and repressive kind of force in his life.
He threatens to move out and she says, no, you never would, which I think tells you an awful lot straight away. She plays up herself quite remarkably. Her line of saying she feels like a cat on a hot tin roof and then says, that's from a play. I'm like, does anyone know what play that possibly could have been from? I don't know if you've seen Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I actually saw it like recently in a sort of weirdly amateur dramatic form, if anyone has criticisms of the actors, the British and New Zealand actors doing Southern accents in this show, I recommend not trying to see local theatre in Ealing, West London, where people, British actors, trying to do Southern accents for Cat and Hot Tin Roof.
I should super need to see that, actually, now, so.
It's a good play. It's fine. It is what it is.
All right, so we get Sheriff Dearborn interviewing Sookie. Sookie is kind of scanning everybody's thoughts, trying to pick up what anybody might know. There's a lot of disturbing shit going on, like specifically with Mike Spencer, who is the coroner/mortician, who is also extremely ghoulish. And he's thinking about how hot she is and like how she's got these natural tits and like good job, God, or whatever. And then later on when he and his assistant are carrying the body outside and he's like, oh, you don't have to be careful with her. You know, she's already dead. And it just made me think about how there's been a lot of like, I think, Twitter threads and like TikToks lately talking about how morgues prefer not to hire men because of the tendency to have like defiled corpses, with men having sex with the dead bodies that come in. And just Mike Spencer, I don't want to think too hard about what Mike Spencer is doing in the wee hours, but
I was not aware of that trend. And
there's been a couple of Twitter threads and then I saw some TikToks about it, but it's apparently it's a whole thing that morgues prefer not to hire men because of the amount of bodies that get fucked, and it's disgusting. Yeah. And Mike Spencer, he's definitely, I'm not suspicious.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a disgusting discrimination, and you should write your Republican congressman to get more men back into morticians. I think particularly the contrast of, as you say, him basically just ogling her boobs, and then as they bring out the body, and they notably introduce the new apprentice as well, but basically going, don't worry, she's not good, she's dead.
Showing just a complete lack of respect and concern for the body, which makes me think that he is not above doing other things with that body, and that's just disgusting.
Well, particularly
Mike Spencer, you're not that nice.
Yeah, Sheriff Dearborn is like, well, you know, you shouldn't have touched anything in the crime scene. Mm-hmm. And yet, clearly, there's no respect for what if she gets random bruising or something. I don't know if people can get bruised when they're dead, but I don't feel like it's, I feel like it's creating something that might then need to be explained.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that we're going to be seeing any kind of like CSI bon ton.
No.
I don't, there's not a lot going on there.
No, it's sort of, our replacement for CSI is Sookie's psychic thoughts, right?
Right, yeah.
Or telepathic, yeah.
All right, so after Faye recounts the fight that Jason and Dawn had the night before that she witnessed, Jason is arrested and put in the back of the police car, upon which realizing he still has a full vial of vampire blood that he got from Lafayette, so he just knocks the whole thing back. Afterwards, he like shoves the vial between the which why couldn't you just shove the full vial between the cushions? Because you're just as fucked if they find an empty vial of what is obviously blood. So
I don't
just
think...
and he just he's Jason Stackhouse. So me expecting any kind of thought process there is like the very definition of insanity. But yeah, just Jason.
Yeah, my suspicion he's paid a lot of money for it, so he's not going to waste it. And clearly did not pay any attention when Lafayette was like one drop max two.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, I need to destroy the evidence and then just put shove it between the cushions.
Yeah, he's just Jason. I that's all. Just there's no explanation needed. It's just Jason being fucking Jason. So they drag him back to the police station, and they, I mean, and Andy here is just gunning so hard. You're just grasping at anything to try to nail Jason with this. And you kind of, I mean, I find Andy Belfleur so frustrating because he is just like a dog with a bone. He's just like the most obnoxious kind of cop in that way.
Mm.
But I do kind of understand that, like, he's looking for respect amongst a town full of people that you know, grew up babysitting him and grew up, you know, taking, you know, watched him grow up. So none of them, you know, he's Andy, he's not a detective. So I can see that frustration, but he's also absolutely the kind of person who should not ever become a cop. Like anybody should ever become a cop, but like somebody like him who demands respect and who will kind of go to extreme things to try to gain that respect is obviously not somebody who should have any kind of power. But yeah, so he's not doing the best job of interviewing Jason. Jason meanwhile is just sporting a raging boner because the V has hit him. He runs to the bathroom to investigate it. It is not looking good for our Jason. And but then Tara shows up and she makes excuses. She's, you know, says that she was with him the night before and is able to get him out. And, you know, because they don't have anything to charge him with anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely take your point about like, yeah, what do you not do with someone with an inferiority complex who mm-hmm. feels like they're owed respect? Give them a badge and a gun.
Right. Yeah. But,
Tara is pretty good. She sort of comes in and starts asking about Miranda rights and have they charged mm-hmm. him or processed him properly or have they given him any reason. Basically, Bud doesn't think he did it anyway, so is sort of slightly doesn't push hard to keep him and lets her take him mm-hmm. away. She also basically, you know, Tara makes some interesting points. That just because vampires are out in the open doesn't mean racism has disappeared. So people look at mixed race couples differently.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of thought in my notes, there's a fantastic podcast called Nanny Ogg's Book Club by a friend of the pod, Tessa, who and her co-host Nigel, who were reading through Terry Pratchett books. And there's a thing in that where slowly but surely you get more and more different races mixing in the same city. So you get dwarves and you get trolls and you get vampires and ghouls and golems and stuff. And in that case, that is a cause for racism to disappear. It's like, why would you hate someone with the same, with a different skin color, when there is a dwarf and a troll that you could hate instead? But yeah, I think she makes some very interesting points here, and sort of intersectional points as well.
Yeah,
I think her particular criticism when Andy is like, you know, where did you know this, or how did you hear about Miranda rights? Is she was like, do you asking me that because I'm a female or a black female?
Yeah,
it's like, it's a good pushback.
All right, so then Suki is back with Gran discussing the whole Jason situation, and then Gran brings up a good point about how, you know, this gift that she has can be seen as just, I mean, obviously it's a heavy weight for Suki to carry. It's really tough to deal with. But it can also be something that's used for good. If it's something that you can't help but have anyway, you might as well try to use it for good purposes. We get the background too, that Suki's grandfather had the same ability as her. So this appears to be something genetic, and he was able to use it, in the past to kind of thwart suicide attempts and stuff like that. So she decides that she can use this power to try to clear Jason's name and look into people's thoughts and see if she can pick anything up, which is kind of troubling on its own when she ends up at work later, reading everybody's thoughts about Dawn. And it's just, you know, predictably terrible, with everybody, you know, half the people blaming her, just doing some really nasty victim blaming, or blaming Jason. So either way, you know, it's just really nasty thoughts to listen in on. However, she does get, she picks up a little bit from Hoyt, where he's the only person, literally the only person in the entire place that is not A, objectifying, B, victim blaming, or C, blaming Jason. All he's thinking about is how he's going to miss Dawn because she had such a beautiful smile. And that is just, Hoyt, you are a sweet little precious baby angel.
Yeah, and he also says, like, I don't even know what she sounded like because I never had the courage to speak to her, which is like, oh, buddy.
Yeah.
Buddy, we love you, Hoyt.
He's the very definition of a good boy.
Yes, he is a good boy, good dog, unlike some other dog related people in this show.
So Tara shows up late for work, and after, you know, saving Jason from the cops, and asks Sam to play along with the alibi because she was with Sam the previous night, not Jason. And he kind of rightfully is like, what is with this torch you carry for Jason? And she says, oh, you know, he's actually very, very deep on the inside or something. And then it, you know, cut to Jason just furiously jerking it, trying to save the situation, which I love because it's Jason has found himself in the ironic punishment division of hell. He's, you know, perpetual horn dog. Jason cannot get his boner to go away, no matter how much he jerks off or how many orgasms he has, which is also very fitting.
He also has a massive blister on his thumb.
Yes,
which is disgusting. And the implication is that his cock looks worse than that, I think. Which is like, Jason, we know you're a dummy, but like, use lube, dude. Like, honestly,
I don't. There's... Who's dry? You know what? I don't even want to think about it.
So it's quite graphic, actually, that blister.
And I've seen this show like several times, at least the first season I've seen several times. And just every time, that moment where he picks his hand up and you see that humongous, it's just, it's so visceral. It's disgusting.
Yeah, so let that be a lesson to whoever the hell's listened to this, I guess.
If you didn't already know, use lube, friends. And also maybe go to a doctor if you have a condition that persists over several hours.
Yeah, I think we'll get to it later, but I think Sam calls Tara on her crush on Jason pretty much in the same way we've been doing for the last sort of few episodes of the pod.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, we later on do get a little bit more deep dive and explanation on that. But there was a couple of scenes in this episode which were what watchers of Buffy or Angel might call an ironic segue fairy between where, for example, this one is Tara going, what is it she said? There's more to Jason than meets the eye. Deep down, he is a very good person. A smash cut to moaning porn on the television and a blister hand, sweaty Jason.
That's probably one. Definitely the Buffy fan in me that loves an ironic cut.
Not the last time I'm going to bring up Buffy in this episode, actually.
All right, so back at the bar, Bill shows up, and Arlene is not great. She's very discriminatory towards him. Obviously, she's blaming vampire presence for all the deaths. And also, she does a weird victim blamey thing as well, blaming Dawn for not showing up and leaving them in a lurch at work, which is just, you know, she's dead, babe. She's dead. That was not her fault. So Sookie brings him his true blood because Arlene's being a dick. And then Sookie brings Bill outside and asks him, tells him that she's trying to pick up on some thoughts to try to clear Jason's name, and wonders if, because Dawn and Maudette were both known to frequent the vampire bar Fangtasia in Shreveport, asks Bill if he will take her.
Yeah, I think in the meantime, Jason cuts from watching porn to going to talk to Lafayette about this V. And and Lafayette is fairly unimpressed and just finds the whole situation funny, which, let's be honest, it's pretty funny. But Jason, particularly great turn of phrase, describes it as gout of the dick, which I thought was a compelling visual picture.
And also, like, Lafayette, this is kind of on you, because Jason is just the last person in the world you want to sell drugs to, because he is the type that will show up at your work with an unrelenting boner and yell very loudly about how you sold him V. He is not subtle. Jason does not know the meaning of the word. So
I mean there's, I don't know, not being a massively aware, au fait with that many drug dealers, but I don't know how subtlety is always, certainly not a media portrayal of drug dealers is always top of the list.
In the same way you want to be a discerning drug buyer, you also want to be a discerning drug seller and make sure that you're not selling to somebody who's going to be a liability. And Jason has liability tattooed on his forehead.
Yes, it's just under gullible, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
So after Sookie makes plans with Bill, she runs inside to tell Sam that she's going to be leaving, after which they have a pretty disturbing conversation about Sam and his supporting the vampire civil rights, but wanting a separate but equal situation.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, actually, like reflecting on the last four episodes, is I genuinely think they're setting up this season reasonably okay, if you don't know who's who, that an awful lot of people could have been the people who killed Maudette and killed Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a pretty wide cast, and they've been sort of seeding in people. They've been, you know, you're pretty sure it's not Jason, but really, mm-hmm. and it's not Sookie or Tara, but really, almost anyone else on the show could be the killer. And I think they've done a good job, actually. As annoying as I find Sam, and as patronizing and as Xandry as I find him, they are deliberately sort of trying to undermine his character to make you suspect him, I think.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to later as well.
Yeah, the final scene in particular is pretty...
Yeah.
Pretty suspicious. All right, so then Bill and Sookie are driving to Shreveport to go to Fantasia. He tells her she looks like vampire bait, which is... It is funny when they get there to the bar and you see everybody is very, like, it's very vinyl and leather and fishnet and collars, and she's there in, like, a white and pink, like, sundress, basically, with her cute little headband. It is very, I like the incongruous kind of contrast there.
It reminds me, okay, I wasn't actually expecting to make a Buffy reference here, but I'm going to make a Buffy reference here. What is it, Doppelgangland, when Cordy goes to the dimension where Buffy was, or she wishes that Buffy had never come to Sunnydale, and everyone's basically telling her off for wearing bright clothing because it'll attract vampires.
Oh yeah, that one's, I think, the wish. Doppelgangland is when
it's the wish.
Vampire right. Willow comes back.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, but that when they're driving to the bar, because there's also previously Sookie has insisted that this wasn't a date, and
she
they
absolutely
are,
dresses like it's a date.
It is very, they flirt very adorably. They have excellent chemistry.
Yeah,
it's hard to know.
And just like that's not a dress you just wear to a bar. That's a dress you're wearing to impress. And she's looking to impress Bill, even if she tells herself she isn't.
Yeah. But particularly because he plays straight into it. He embraces the it's not a date and teases her a bit about it as well, and is withholding in a flirty way. I really enjoyed that scene. They do go well together, I think.
Yeah, it is kind of sweet to see somebody who's, 170-something years old just kind of do cutesy, like, almost high school-level flirting.
Definitely.
All right, so back at Merlot's, Tara goes into the storage fridge and sees Jason on the floor with, as you've noted in the notes here, meat on his meat. she gets a good look at it, which is probably not the context she has always wanted to get a good look at it, and makes the very smart decision that he needs to go to the doctor immediately, which, you know, he tries to deny, but, like, when it comes down to it, do you want your dick or do you not want your dick? Because one of those options is going to get you to keep your dick. So they go to the hospital.
Yeah, he gets treated there by the doctor, who's like, have you taken any drugs? And lists various drugs and then goes vampire blood. Mm-hmm. And Jason is like, no, how could you?
Just
Jason,
like,
again,
this overwrought reaction
not,
to
not
that
the most convincing
particular.
Actor. And right. The doctor's like, right.
Yeah, he gets this 12 times a day at least.
What a fun job.
It's, I know. It's so funny, too, because, like, you don't, you know, the doctors are not... good, you know, they're not out here to rat on you. They're just trying to make sure you don't have a drug interaction. But Jason is Jason, and he do be a dum-dum. So he goes ahead and lies. He gets a giant needle in his dick for his efforts to...
The doctor also says that his dick looks like an eggplant, which is a wonderful emoji reference, in my opinion.
It is, yes.
I don't know whether iPhones had actually come out and eggplants had been officially used as emojis for this yet.
I feel like this predates the eggplant emoji as dick thing. But, I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel like it predates it and maybe it was just like the...
Yeah, I don't know whether you got... I'm gonna switch and call them aubergines because I... will I can't remember whether you used to get them in like AIM and ICQ and stuff like that,
maybe in
instant messaging before that, or at what point. We'll have to investigate that.
I know we need to go look up
back
the
time.
the history of the
is it know your meme? Yeah. When did an eggplant mean a dick?
So back at Fantasia, Asuki meets Pam, love of my life, and some other vampires around, the bartender Long Shadow, and she's asking people if they saw them, who they saw them with, but as predicted, most people are pretty trying to keep everything pretty under wraps, as is as you would expect in that kind of environment, where anonymity is highly valued.
She's so bubbly and genuine. It's in the face of, like, this is really Barbie girlfriend, Oppenheimer boyfriend material in terms of the energy of this bar. Spoilers for whenever this podcast does come out. This is the week that Barbie and Oppenheimer are coming out in the cinema.
The Barbenheimer.
Yes. But she's just so, like, earnest. I think everyone's just taken aback by it.
Yeah. I know, she's like the only person in there that isn't wearing leather or like that kind of wet look vinyl stuff.
Yeah.
And this is also where we get our first look at Eric sitting on a throne where he belongs, overlooking his small little empire. And people literally crawling at his feet.
That's true. And he kicks one of them in the head. Mm-hmm. They fly across the room. And then a vampire pops their teeth and basically pulls them into the bathroom to feed on him.
Yeah.
Like earlier we had a conversation between Bill and Suki where Suki's like, this is feels like what a vampire bar would be like in Disneyland. And Bill
it's
is
such
like,
an apt description too. It really is.
It really feels like that, but Bill is also like, yeah, it's not going to stay like that.
Mm-hmm. This is the surface. Yeah, shit will get real at some point, as it does. So, you know, Suki continues to scan at Fantasia. Eric notices them, of course, and summons them over. And Suki asks him about Maudette and Dawn, and it seems like I think he's pointing at the picture of Maudette when he says, you know, this one tried, but I, you know, she was too pathetic for me. And then, but he does say that he fed off of Dawn, which I think implies that he was the one who left those bite marks on her inner thigh. And good for them both is all I have to say about that.
I found it interesting that I agree that that's the sort of implication I took, but they definitely don't show which one is which in the episode. They so I like the fact that they make you interpret that.
Yeah.
So maybe it was the other way around, but it is kind of the way it feels.
Mm-hmm. I know that we've talked a lot about vampirism being kind of a parallel to queerness in this show, and I think that's especially apparent in this Fantasia scene, because it really does, you know, she Suki is sitting there and she realizes that there's an undercover cop there and that they're planning a raid, and Eric says, well, there's nothing to worry about, we're not, you know, they're obviously very careful not to do illegal things, like Pam says when they first get there, you know, that they have to really toe the line about not serving anything or anyone underage. And then that's when Suki realizes that there is, you know, that guy that Eric had kicked is being fed on in the bathroom. And then the raid starts, but that just, it really harkens back to the days, you know, like Stonewall, you know, where there were a ton of police raids being conducted on queer spaces and bars that were rumored to be gay bars. So that was another very, very obvious kind of nod to that, to queerness and queer history.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's pretty clear what they're doing with the analogy here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, there are people in the bar as well who are like, it's, you know, it's not gay if it's a vampire, right?
Yeah.
and just like we had earlier with one of Suki's dates being like, Maybe if I start dating her, all of those feelings about Jake Gyllenhaal from Jarheads will go out of my brain. So they're being very overt about that, mm-hmm. which is unsurprising from Alan Ball, but
mm-hmm. yeah. All right, so Eric and Pam and Bill and Sookie are all able to get out of the bar and not, you know, have any police interactions there. And then we go back to Tara is driving Jason back home after the hospital. He's sleeping in the car. And I think we get some pretty important context and background on this relationship, too, because as we have noted several times, and probably will continue to note for a while, that Tara's crush on Jason just seems like, why? obviously, he's very pretty, but Tara is so much smarter and she's got so much more sense than to, you know, the way who she is around Jason is just not who she is in any other context. So, but we do get some background on that I think is really important, because we see that when she was a child and running from her mom, who was drunk, and she runs to their house, so the Stackhouse house, and looking for refuge from her mother, and no one is there but Jason, and he protects her. He brings her inside and then threatens to call the cops on Tara's mother if she doesn't leave and leave Tara alone. And that kind of thing is just like a foundational sort of impression. It's very fundamental to her relationship with Jason. And, you know, it's understandable that she would be kind of almost revert to that little girl again around him, where she just is in awe of him and almost worshipful based on just the way that he protected her.
Yeah, and as much as we malign Jason's stupidity, this does feel in character for him mm-hmm. as well. It does feel like he would stand up against Tara's drunk mother and say, I don't know you, I know her, she's allowed in, you're not. Mm-hmm. I'll call the police on you and tell people all about you if you don't leave her alone.
Go. I was just going to say, I especially love his, there's not going to be any Captain Morgan in jail for you. Like, that's a pretty astute observation from him as well, that would be what gets her to lay off, is that if she goes to jail, she's not going to get any more booze.
And it's exactly is what gets her to leave, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it is spot on, which is the sort of, weirdly, the sort of smart but obvious insight that mm-hmm. That Jason might have. Like, it's just an obvious thing, because one of the things that's driven this is that Tara poured out her bottle of Captain Morgan, which is why she's chasing her. And just on the back end of the raid, basically Sookie is using her telepathic ability to realize there's going to be a raid. But I really like the way the vampires are moving out of the bar. So you've got this impression that they're doing their whizzy super speed stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill is carrying Sookie and is sort of moving a little bit more like he's running. But like Pam and Eric are moving a bit more like they're on wheels, sort of, like mm-hmm. it's just a slightly weird,
they're on that walkway at the airport, you know.
yeah There's just a weird aesthetic to the move, but I really liked it. And it's clear that because Sookie also pushes back a little bit on when Sookie gets summoned.
Sookie pushing back,
she pushes back, she's not afraid. I mean, you can tell she's a little bit afraid, but she's not. She doesn't let that stop her asking. She's very polite. Again, she's very earnest. Mm-hmm. But she's also weirdly sarcastic with Pam in a way that I find kind of fun.
Yeah, and I think they do too.
They do too, yeah.
That's what
They're
I
very
like,
intrigued by her.
What I really like about Sookie is she kind of uses politeness as a weapon almost. You know, like, you can't say that she's being outwardly rude because she is being polite, but it's like a sharp politeness. It's a, I'm being polite, are you going to be polite? You know what I mean? Like, it's got an edge to it. And I really like that about her, that she's, you know, because he's like, oh, aren't you sweet? And she's like, no, I'm not.
No. It's good, but I also quite like how Bill is in this. He's deferential, but he's not like simpering, if that makes sense. Like he's, you know, there's clearly some history with him and Pam and him and Eric and all three of them, and it's clear that he's sort of lower on the rungs of the ladder, as it were. But yeah, but he's still like he doesn't back down. He's quite cool and collected, actually, in ways that I quite like about his character at this point.
Which I think is then kind of turned on its head when he and Sookie are driving home and they pull over because Sookie's having a moment and she needs to decompress. And then one of the cops that
and
was
also
because
Bill is playing Cambodian music,
right? Yeah. Which is a nice touch. I like that it's kind of just an interesting little character note that, like, it makes sense that even as this, you know, southern-baked old white dude that you would, after so many years of living, kind of broaden your horizons and, yeah, and you know, you are going to get sick of your own music and your own culture after a while and kind of go looking into places that others might not expect from you to look. But, yeah, it is kind of turned on its head when the cop comes up behind them and like all the coolness and Bill is gone. He has zero patience left for anything and he kind of escalates a situation instead of the opposite.
I think what's interesting is I don't feel he escalates it because he takes control of the situation. Because Sookie starts it by saying, "Let me do the talking."
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he just basically loses his patience and just says, "Well, I can glamour this guy into giving me his gun and end this." But I also think back to your point about the Stonewall equivalences. I think what you have is the cop pulling them over and saying, "Well, we raided a bar. You know, were you at that bar?" Basically, it's like, that is a ridiculous thing to pull someone over.
Well, in particular, that he's asking to see parts of Sookie's body to prove that they were not participating in that, which is, I think, you know, is obviously a step way too far, and it's very invasive, and that is what makes Bill, you know, escalate or whatever the situation.
He's fine, and he's like, "I'm a man of few words," and he does that thing. It isn't until they're asking to see, her neck and everything.
Yeah,
it's a. But anyway, he glamours him and, but lets him go, which is basically he probably wouldn't have done if Sookie hadn't been there.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so as we know, this show always ends with a cliffhanger, and usually they're pretty wild, but this one is more puzzling or disturbing than anything else. We see Sam, he goes to Dawn's house. What we see before he's walking Arlene to her car because she's scared, because obviously, you know, shit's pretty wild out there right now. And as he's turning out the lights and locking up the bar, he grabs some gloves. Latex gloves or whatever, and he shoves them in his pocket before they leave. And then we see what he does with them is he goes to Dawn's house, he puts the gloves on, and then he like rolls around, like writhes around in her bed and sniffs, you know, where she was, where she died. And it's pretty, I would say this one is like less cliffhangery and more just kind of
creepy as fuck.
Yeah, you're just like, what?
You're right. Like the other cliffhangers are like reasonably clear what's going on. This is just like, wait, what? Also, I don't understand why he's putting gloves on if he's then just gonna roll around.
He's like leaving his hair, his all kind. You know, there's other DNA. It's not just fingerprints. You know, but whatever. As we've established, Bontemps does not have a thriving CSI department, so I guess he's probably.
Well, but even with that, like they know he's got keys to her place because they asked him for them earlier,
yeah,
and he's like the landlord. So it's like his fingerprints would be completely explicable anyway.
Right.
His hair from rolling around on her bed is less so.
Less so, yeah. For sure. That's funny too. There's another mark against Sam is that he is a landlord, so even more suspicious, I say.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an odd one, that. So I guess we got a couple of new characters this episode.
Oh, yeah.
So we got Pam and Eric. So do we want to do a little bit of focus on each of those?
Yeah.
Should we start with Pam? She doesn't have too many lines, but quite the imposing presence as we mm-hmm. meet her.
I love that right away with Pam, you're like, this is not a straight woman. I appreciate yeah. the clarity, you know. She never forgets a pretty face.
She does say when they're showing them her, showing her and Eric the photos of Maudette and Dawn, that they're not her type.
Mm-hmm.
But she does it in a way that implies it's not that they were women. That
it was not the gender, it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see an obvious devotion between her and Eric right away, which I think is a relationship that I find very important in this whole show. I think the show finds it equally yes. important as well, but it is just something that's very close to my heart because I love them both so much and I love their relationship, their dynamic throughout the entire series. I think that's just something I'm going to be paying a lot of attention to going forward.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, obviously Eric is the one on the throne and Pam is front of house, but but it's clear there's a respect there. They talk in Aramaic to each other at some point, which is mm-hmm. a slightly odd choice when you come down to it.
Yeah.
But it's a fun dynamic, and she's very clearly in charge, knows what she's about, and mm-hmm. And has a past relationship with Bill as well. And then we have Eric, who very much to me seems like the Spike to Bill's angel circa season two pre.
I had a friend who kind of dubbed this kind of phenomenon that was like it's the second love interest is always the blonde, like the second blonde love interest, and how we had. I know that you are not. A Spike fan at all. I am a Spike fan, but so it lines up for me, probably not for you because you don't like Spike, but my friend always said that it was the second blonde love interest that was always the superior one.
So I like Spike in season two of Buffy.
Mm-hmm.
I do not like Spike in season six of Buffy.
Yeah,
is where I go. And I don't,
that's fair. Yeah.
I don't massively like him in season five of Angel either, but that's a different thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's funny because you can kind of track that in a lot of shows. Actually, it is kind of like a strange little phenomenon that there is always like a second love interest. The first one is always dark haired and brooding. The second one is always blonde and a little chaotic. And I think that's kind of despite I'm not usually one for blondes, but I do like that. The chaos is the attraction there.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit like good boy first, then bad boy mm-hmm. sort of energy to that. And I think Eric is, whilst he's, again, sort of serene and in control, similarly to Bill, he's sort of more vital and more embracing of who mm-hmm. he is. Whereas Bill is obviously mainstreaming, which is what vampires who are not drinking human blood say, even though Bill has drunk human blood, both the rat trays and others recently, I think.
Perhaps Bill isn't mainstreaming as much as he'd like people to believe he is.
Yeah. But also, like, there's there's the broody. I think Angel as a character becomes far more interesting when he gets his own show.
Oh, absolutely.
In season two of that show. And I think that Cordelia as a foil for him is far more compelling than Buffy ever was. Mm-hmm. I think he's he's a brood in the shadows in season one and early season two of Buffy. I think the
they give him a personality in his own show.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, the sort of genius of what happens in season two and the metaphor of that is perfect. But that is a story about Buffy much more than it is really about Angel. So yeah, I'm not sure it's the last time, Tasia, me and you will talk about these two characters.
Lozzy and Tasia's Buffy rewatch podcast.
I'm literally just wrapping up one Angel rewatch podcast at the moment.
Are you?
So shout out to Angel on Topcast. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They have got like 4 episodes left of season 5. So
wow.
It's been interesting watching them go through the sort of Spike integration into the show and how that, I would say, mostly didn't work, and it sort of works a bit towards the end. But but that's there are many factors behind that, which we don't need to go into because this is not a Buffy and Angel podcast. But yeah, but that's talking about Spike and Angel more than it is talking about Eric. Eric is sort of basically a Viking god who sits on a throne and looks down on people. And as you say, they crawl to him and he kicks some away and tastes some others and basically does whatever the hell he wants and looks pretty glorious whilst doing so. I think I would pick Pam over Eric, but like there's a piece of paper in between them in that choice.
Yeah, no, totally. I think I'm in full agreement with that, actually.
Okay, right. So we've then got our sort of what's most chaotic section. So I had sort of 2 or 3 things that I picked out. One is, one I already mentioned was... this one I didn't. This was another sort of smash cut, which is Hoyt's mother saying to be a fly on the wall in that apartment right now. And it cuts to a fly crawling on Dawn's dead lips, which is much less a comedy segue, but a pretty pretty good one either way. There was also in Fantasia, there's a picture on the wall of George W. Bush as a vampire feeding on the Statue of Liberty. So, you know, a subtle criticism.
About as subtle as a hammer.
Yeah. And then just, yeah, the doctor going, I need to drain the blood out of your penis. Mm-hmm. It seems like a line from a porno. Did you have any particularly chaotic moments?
I think I'm just going to co-sign yours. I feel like I had one and then I lost it. But yeah, no, I mean, just all of Jason as an entire being in this episode is extremely chaotic.
Both chaotic. And then again, I would say he's not as horny as he normally is because of his permanent erection. This is the first episode we've seen where he doesn't have sex with anyone, right?
Right, yeah. The aforementioned ironic punishment division that he's currently residing in.
Bill is still obsessed with feeding from the femoral artery, and it's the second time he's brought it up. But I do think it's not as horny, but the flirtation between Bill and Sookie, both on the sort of porch outside my lots and then in the car, I found very, very adorable, very attractive.
Yeah, I think in terms of like blatant horniness, this show is much lower. This episode is much lower compared to the previous ones, which is totally fine. But yeah, we get the more subtle. We get the sweet flirting between Bill and Sookie, and we get just like Eric and Pam and their entire existence. Not necessarily with each other, but just in general. Both of them have an extreme and absurd amount of just like sexual magnetism that in itself is horny enough for me.
I mean, we probably should include the entirety of the Fantasia bar in this as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where there are pole dancers and people wearing very little, but very much gothed up, and everyone.
Sookie's observation that everybody is only thinking about sex, 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 and Bill's very, you know, rightfully pointing out that you don't need to be a psychic to figure that out.
Yeah, but again, he does it in such a sort of teasing, mm-hmm. fun way that you can tell that she appreciates it.
Yeah,
I think. Cool. Well, is there anything you particularly else wanted to mention about this episode?
No, I don't think so. I don't even have any like spoilery notes for future book anything. I think I'm
good. Yeah, I mean, I've not read the book, so the only thing I can think about is just, I don't know whether we're assuming that Sam sort of writhing around in Dawn's bed is like supposed to be him being a dog, you know, missing his significant human or something.
Yeah, I think that this episode does a really interesting thing with that, is because they have like very clearly seeded Sam having some sort of like dog animal affinity situation thing happening, that is he the dog, is he not the dog? So this episode kind of pulls the rug out from underneath you with that, with him having the dog run up to him while he's outside. So then you're like, okay. Before, you're like, I've never seen the dog and Sam in the same place at once, but now you have. So now you're like, okay, well, maybe he's not the dog. But then you see the end of this episode where he's getting weird with the sniffing and the sheets and the rolling around. So that seems like a kind of animal affinity thing. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then we've also sort of, they've slowly been seeding a little bit more character growth for a lot of the minor characters as well. We mentioned this with like Hoyt, and you get a bit more of Renee and Arlene in this as well. And you're getting slightly more of Bard and Andy, and you're getting slightly more of the coroner, whose name I forget.
Mike Spencer.
Mike Spencer as well. So they've done... I think if I look across the four episodes, like the first one, I think we all said like basically a pitch perfect pilot, mm-hmm. like really hit everything well. The second sort of deepened character growth on sort of our four main characters. And then the third one probably moved the plot along. And then the fourth one, I think, has sort of added a bit more depth to the other characters. So you can sort of see, again, like, you know, I would give a lot of credit to the effectiveness of the storytelling across these four episodes. Is they're not diving and slowing too much down to get into characters. Like, we're all going, why the hell is Tara doing this with Jason? And we only have to really wait till episode four to find that out, or at least find an explanation that I think we could all find credible, right?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think the pacing has been really, really well done so far.
All right.
I think we did want to bring in kind of a new segment. We were thinking, because we do often talk about the cliffhangers and just kind of how iconic the cliffhangers in this show are and how it kind of became known for them. So we thought it might be fun to rank the cliffhangers as we go.
We have four cliffhangers to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that's the first episode, where the Rat Rays beat the shit out of Sookie. The second episode, where Sookie turns up at Bill's house and the Weird Eyes back tattoo vampire is there. The third one, where Dawn is dead. And then the fourth one, where Sam goes to Dawn's bedroom and is sniffing and writhing on her bed. So I'm going to say, like, I think the pilot is the best one so far.
I have the pilot at number two, and I have Dawn is dead at number one.
Okay. I was going to say the other way around, but those were my one and two.
Yeah, they're pretty close. Yeah. I'd be willing to concede that Rattray is at number one, just because it is also the first one. So it is kind of the most punchiest, because, you know, we didn't know what the show was about until until it dropped that on us, really.
Okay, so that's our one and two. And then...
So I have Sam at number four, just because I don't feel like it's a super, it's not like a punchy cliffhanger in the same way that a lot of these other ones are. It's more just kind of like a what the fuck moment.
I was close between these two. I think notably these two are sort of a level below mm-hmm. those first two. I think that Sam is more of a what the fuck than a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, but equally I'm thinking about it a bit more. So I wasn't sure again where it's at there, but I think I'm willing to go with that as well. So
yeah.
Okay, so that gives us as our first four ranked cliffhangers. Number one, the rat race beat the shit out of Sookie. Mm-hmm. Number two, Dawn is dead. Number three, Sam going to... No, wait, sorry, that's the wrong way around. It's not what we said. Number three is Sookie turning up at Bill's house with the weird eyes back tattoo vampire. And number four is Sam going to Dawn's bedroom and sniffing and writhing on her bed. And acting a bit weird. Anything you want to plug?
You can. I do have this other podcast called Act Your Age. We kind of dive into and do some critical analysis on a lot of popular YA fiction. We also kind of expand that a little bit. Our definition of YA has gone through some different iterations, but we kind of at this point we're more or less doing what we want, which a lot of it is YA, some of it is not. But yeah, you can find us at actyh.com. You can find us at actyh on Instagram, Twitter, and actyhpod@gmail.com. If you like YA, if you like books, if you like chaotic, corny book discussions, then you can find me there.
Awesome. And I'm at Lozymandias on Blue Sky now. I'm basically just like winding down Twitter, I'll be honest. And you can also find me looking for joy and inspiration in Isaac Asimov on the Asimov Cast. And you should be able to find that wherever you find podcasts. All right.
So thank you very much to DJ Empirical for our theme. You can find the pod on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky at FangBangersPod, and email us your chaotic, corny thoughts. Let's stick it to True Blood at FangBangersPod@gmail.com. Next week will be the episode Sparks Fly Out. That will be episode 5. Until then, I am Tasia, and my blood type is Jason's eggplant.
And I'm Lozzie, and my blood type is Pam. Bye.
Bye.